With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, new details about USDA's Agricultural Outlook Forum program, and also why the USDA is surveying California cattle operations this month. But we start out today with this from Cindy Zimmerman.
All right, well, here at the Ag Gateway annual meeting in Nashville, and one of the newer areas that Ag Gateway is getting into as far as technology and standards is animal agriculture. We had a meeting on that yesterday. I have a couple of people that were attending that meeting. And first of all, guys, if you'd introduce yourself for me, please.
I'm Philip Kwish. I'm IT director at VitaPlus Corporation in Madison, Wisconsin.
Peter Schott, S-C-H-O-T-T. I'm the senior account manager for North America for Format Solutions.
All right. Well, both of you were in the meeting. And Philip, what do you think? What is your takeaway from the conversation yesterday?
I think the takeaway is we're starting to get some traction and people are going to be interested in doing some standards from an animal agriculture standpoint. We've done a lot on the crop side and on the at the field level, but we know we need to do more on the animal agriculture side.
What do you think, Peter?
It's really exciting to see that, you know, as we've watched innovation in agriculture, it's kind of followed the crop from production to consumption. And so we're starting to see that now on the animal side, and exciting to see that happening here with this group.
A lot of discussion related to the different species and the fact that especially in the hog business and the poultry business, you're vertically integrated and how that would play out as far as standards is concerned. What do you think is the most important areas to look at right now, Philip?
In terms of animal agriculture, I think it's just sustainability probably is one of the biggest buzzwords that I've been hearing. I mean, everywhere you look, they talk about sustainability. And so I think we have the framework in place where we can start looking into collecting or providing some of that information digitally for our customer, for players in the animal ag sector.
What about you, Peter?
I would agree with Phil. There's a lot of questions about what is sustainable exactly and how is that measured and how is it tracked. So as those conversations are happening in the industry, to have people that are involved in that at a direct frontline level from the different parts of the supply chain is really important, and that will really drive what happens here on the data collection side for the traceability piece of it.
Is this going to be really important internationally, especially for, you know, when we have exports?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think if you look internationally, I think Europe is probably, or other parts of the world, are leading the way in that. And I think we're coming to the table a little late, and other continents have gotten the jump on us, and we need to start to take a look at that and address it.
What do you think?
Well, I worked directly in that space for about 6 years before coming into my current role, so we could talk a long time about that. But yeah, they're like Phil said, you know, Europe and Southeast Asia, I said, are way ahead of the curve on this, and either regulations that have been handed down to them through governmental or consumer demand on things. So the export market is huge for that. I wouldn't say necessarily directly related to what's happening at Ag Gateway, because there's not a lot of export work here, but I think the industry here can look at what's been happening, what are the trends that are going on in those parts of the world, and shape, well, what do we do with that and how do we operate with it here?
Well, as far as getting started, you mentioned sustainability. Is there any specific, I mean, when we talked about starting a working group, where do we start as far as animals is concerned?
Well, I think it's going to start tomorrow. We have a working group that's starting at least the initial discussions on the dairy feed, and we'll see where that whole group takes us. It might be the start of the whole thing, the whole sustainability topic for animal agriculture.
What do you think about that, Peter? You think dairy is a place to start?
I don't work as much in dairy, and from what I'm hearing here, there's a lot of opportunities there just due to the disparate systems and things that come into play with it. I think further down the road, there's going to be more of a trend for using nutritional data to make better purchasing decisions and also better use of ingredients. If you can get away with using less corn or less soybean meal in a diet, what does that impact down the road on the production side of it too? So there's a lot of opportunities there.
Well, it does seem like you've got that crossover there between the feed and the livestock. We're already looking at the crops and that that's going to be so important as far as traceability is concerned, right?
Correct. Yep. It's the foundational. So, yeah, it's the start. So we just have to get going on it.
Anything else either one of you want to add? All right. Well, great. It was a great discussion, and it's good to see even more expansion here in Ag Gateway. Here at the annual meeting in Nashville, I'm Cindy.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. In today's national spotlight, 2023 brought sharply lower incomes for most producers. Gary Crawford has more.
As farmers close the books on 2023, many of those spreadsheets are showing that overall U.S. farm income in 2023 came down significantly.
But it came down from a level in 2022 that was record high.
USDA Chief Economist Seth Meyer says net cash income for producers this year will come in at just under $158 billion, a 21% drop from 2022. But
still well above the average of the last couple decades. And an interesting fact here is also that the last three consecutive years of farm income are the highest three farm income years in my lifetime.
Lifetime. Okay, so Seth, just how old are you then?
I'm not as young as I like to think I am. How about that?
Okay, but we did check the income report, and 2021, 22, and 23 are the highest three consecutive farm income years in 50 years. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
There is still time for the student in your life to apply for a scholarship from Bayer. Michael Clements reports.
To strengthen the future of agriculture, Bayer Funds Grow Ag Leaders program will once again partner with farmers to award scholarships to students pursuing careers in any agriculture-related field of study. Grow Ag Leaders program representative Jackie Greenblatt says the program was developed to help encourage rural students to pursue careers in agriculture and emphasizes there are many eligible careers both on and off the farm.
The agriculture industry is growing, and the type of in-demand jobs expand well beyond traditional roles such as farming and agronomy. There are jobs in engineering, mathematics, data science, communications, and countless others. Students who are pursuing careers in these areas are eligible to apply for a Grow Ag Leaders Scholarship.
Greenblatt encourages students enrolled or planning to enroll in trade schools, community college, and four-year universities to apply for the $1,500 scholarships.
The program is available to students pursuing ag-related degrees at either a trade school, community college, or traditional four-year university. They just need to have a GPA of 2.5 or higher to qualify. Each applicant must be an FFA member and also needs to receive an endorsement from two local farmers. The program is open now until January 11th, 2024.
Greenblatt emphasizes that the Bayer Fund has a long history of giving back to local rural communities through its various community outreach programs, helping farmers to further strengthen their communities.
Through the Bayer Fund, we've awarded over $65 million to rural communities since 2010. The Grow Ag Leaders program alone has awarded more than $4 million in scholarships to over 2,000 students across the U.S. And this year, we will be giving away over 350 scholarships, totaling more than $500,000.
To learn more about the program, Greenblatt says students should go online to www.fund.bayer.us.
There, students will find information about the program as well as a link to the FFA website to apply. Again, the deadline to apply is January 11th, 2024, and farmer endorsements must be submitted by January 18th, 2024.
Again, learn more online at www.fund.bayer.us. That was Jackie Greenblatt with Bayer, encouraging students in your area to go online and apply today for this scholarship. Don't delay. Applications close on January 11th. Michael Clements reporting.
What are some of the ways USDA's Census of Agriculture provides significant data and useful information to people not associated with ag? Rod Main tells us.
A mid-February release date is set for results from USDA's latest Census of Agriculture. And as Joe Prusacki of the National Agricultural Statistics Service notes, some people not familiar with how the census works seem to have plenty of questions about a survey that has plenty of questions in it. For instance,
I think the biggest question is, why do you mail out or try to collect data from 3+ million farmers? And whereas the farm count in the United States is about 2 million, why? Well, because Farmers are in and out, so you don't necessarily cash. That's one. The other things people ask is, why do you do it? Trust me, it's not cheap to do a census of agriculture. And why do you do it? It's to get that benchmark, that snapshot of what's going on in the United States.
The census every 5 years does create that snapshot in time regarding agriculture. Essential, according to Prasacki, in how much ag has changed during that time, and the data collected affects more than the farm sector. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, today marks the compliance deadline for U.S. pork producers to meet the certification requirements of California's Prop 12. National Pork Producers Council President Scott Hayes discusses the impact.
You know, when California implemented Prop 12, basically what they're doing is they're telling producers all across the country how they have to raise pigs. So they set a standard for pork coming into California. They sold it as a higher animal welfare standard. It is not. It is just a different standard. And so they can change that at any time. They can, and California has a history of doing that, you know, continually moving the goalposts. So it's a challenge all the way across the country. So now producers have to decide, do I produce for the California market or do I produce for everyone else? And if you're going to produce for the California market, there has to be, a monetary incentive to do that because it costs more to raise pigs. It increases the carbon footprint of the farm that's producing for California.
Yet the California consumer is still a concern for pork producers.
So that's been a concern of MPPC's all along, you know, is the consumer in California. Somebody's got to pay the bill. This is an expensive conversion at the farm. And like I said, it's not converting to a higher welfare standard. It's just a different welfare standard. So I'm afraid that the California consumer is going to have buyer's remorse when this gets fully implemented. We've already seen the price of pork that falls under Prop 12. The cost of that in California is up 27%, while the cost of those same products across the rest of the country are actually down 2%. So Californians aren't only seeing, you know, some supply disruptions, they're also already paying a higher price, and that's probably going to continue. And the issue is, you know, that there's just a few cuts that fall under Prop 12 compliance, but those few cuts have to pay the cost on the entire pig because no one else is going to pay that, frankly. You know, if I'm buying pork in Missouri or if we're selling it to someone in another country, they're not interested in paying for Prop 12 standards.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Taking a holistic approach to farming entails a multitude of components. Founder of Abundant Harvest Organics, Vernon Peterson, described what he sees as priorities for a holistic farming system.
You cannot have a holistic system and exclude the farm workers from that system. If you have animals, there has to be some animal welfare in that if you're going to have a holistic system. But on the other hand, consumers first need to be assured that we're not just pulling the toxin out of the system. We are indeed building soil. We are indeed taking care of the people. And so a third-party certification takes care of that and gets rid of the BS that I'm regenerative because I planted a cover crop into no-till GMO UN32 fertilized corn. Okay? There's no way you are being truthful when you say that.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture concluded 2023 by highlighting some of these successes for farmers and rural communities. Under President Biden's Investing in America agenda, the USDA facilitated significant support, including over $1.7 billion in immediate assistance to more than 30,000 distressed farmers. The Risk Management Agency provided a record $207 billion in farm safety net protection. Through the ReConnect program, over $1.8 billion was awarded for 96 projects benefiting 11,000 farms and 7,300 rural businesses. Historic efforts were made to enroll more acreage in voluntary conservation programs, and the Rural Energy for America program invested over $362 million in renewable energy systems. Overall, U.S. agricultural producers achieved a three-year streak of record farm income and exports. The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the U.S. Department of Energy is hosting a series of listening sessions to gather feedback on clean energy development and how it can benefit farmers and rural communities. The agencies are inviting stakeholders to provide comments on the impacts of the increasing levels of clean energy within agricultural land and rural areas. Government permitting and policy representatives at state, county, and local levels are invited to participate in the January 12th session. Two sessions are scheduled for January 16th for agricultural producers, along with all other stakeholders and members of the public. The final session on January 17th is aimed at rural electric co-ops and clean energy developers. The agencies want to hear from stakeholders about what can be done to help guide continued development of clean energy that can benefit farmers, rural Americans, the renewable energy industry, and others. Stakeholders are also invited to provide written comments by January 20th. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service will survey about 2,000 cattle operations in California to provide an up-to-date measure of U.S. cattle inventories. During the first 2 weeks of January, California producers will have the opportunity to report their beef and dairy cattle inventories, calf crop, death loss, and cattle on feed information. To make the survey as convenient as possible for producers to participate, NAS is offering the option of responding via internet, telephone, or mail. The information collected through the survey will help provide a clearer picture of the industry and provide necessary insight for forecasting slaughter volume for future months to determine what might be available for export. The January cattle report will become available on January 31st at nas.usda.gov/publications, along with all other NAS reports. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has provided new details about the 100th Agricultural Outlook Forum coming up in February. During the event, USDA's chief economist will unveil USDA's outlook for the domestic agricultural economy for the new year. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack will highlight the history and evolution of agriculture in the U.S. Secretary Vilsack will also be discussing initiatives aimed at preserving farmland, protecting farmers, and creating new revenue streams for small and mid-sized producers. The plenary panel will feature innovators going over how they're transforming the agricultural landscape. Attendees can learn about the latest advancements and emerging technologies that are reshaping farming and creating new opportunities for farmers today and in the future. The forum is scheduled for February 15th in Arlington, Virginia. More details can be found on the events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
World coffee inventories are expected to shrink this year. That's coming up on This Land of Ours.
I love coffee. I love tea. I love the Java Jive and it loves me.
Well, Americans certainly like their coffee, and U.S. Department of Agriculture analysts are forecasting U.S. imports of coffee this next year to jump from 22.5 million bags in this past season to 24 million this next season. On a global scale, USDA is forecasting world coffee production to hit almost 171.5 million bags, and yes, that would top this past season by almost 7 million, but that won't be enough of an increase to keep world coffee inventories from shrinking down. Analysts project stocks by the end of this next marketing year to drop down to 26.5 million bags. That would be the lowest inventory for coffee in 12 years. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. We go to Chuck Zimmerman now with an update on renewable fuels.
I'm visiting with Robert White with the Renewable Fuels Association. And Robert, since we're getting towards the end of the year, I'd love to get your thoughts on kind of where are we at on the E15 front for ethanol.
Well, so it's a two-pronged approach right now. We obviously have the eight Midwest governors that are still waiting for a rulemaking to happen from EPA requesting them their ability to opt out of the E10 waiver, which essentially puts gasoline on a level playing field no matter if you blend E10 or E15 with it. The reverse is happening in Congress, and that is to extend the one-pound waiver that E10 has enjoyed for decades to E15. And so at the end of the day, we don't care which effort happens. We just need one to happen before next summer, because we can't rely on emergency waivers year after year after year, because there are parameters that those have to meet, guidelines, and ultimately 3 years in a row will be a tough lift.
So in an ideal situation, something would get decided before the end of the year, since then we're in an election year.
Right. And of course, as we know, E15 lowers the price of fuel. So that's a great talking point. The problem is the petroleum companies are saying the opposite. If you disrupt the supply chain, then we'll have – the reality is we've done the math. We've actually utilized three different firms that the petroleum companies use, and we show, in most cases, a penny or two difference. Well, that's washed away with the value proposition of ethanol and by the time you do RINs and margins included. So we have no concern about raising fuel prices. In fact, we've saw this year again, emergency waivers saved consumers billions at the pump thanks to the supply addition of ethanol.
Is there anything else that can be done right now to try to help move that along?
Well, I encourage everyone to, as always, talk to your elected officials and ask them to support year-round E15. It is the number one issue. We've been, unfortunately, fighting this for over a decade now, and everyone, including our elected officials, are tired of it, and they want to get it done so we can focus on bigger and better things. But in the meantime, it's always talk to your elected officials. Thank them when they do well and remind them when they don't.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Robert, for giving us a little update on where we stand on the E15 issue. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting. I'm visiting with Brian Jennings with the American Coalition for Ethanol. And, Brian, while we have the chance here, I'd love to have you talk a little bit about the adoption of the GREET model. Tell us a little bit about this, and we'll delve into it a little bit more.
Yeah, the GREET model might be a little esoteric to some of your readers and listeners, but it's a critically important piece of the puzzle to help farmers and ethanol producers demonstrate that we're part of the carbon solution, that we need to be part of the discussion when it comes to how are we going to decarbonize transportation. GREET is an acronym for a model that was developed by the Department of Energy. The top scientists in the world developed this model to help estimate the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions of all sorts of transportation fuels and technologies. So this doesn't merely apply to ethanol. It applies to any fuel, gasoline, diesel fuel, and it has been adapted to apply to other sort of mobilization technologies, for example, electric vehicles. And so this is the gold standard scientific model by which we want policymakers, not only in the U.S. but around the globe, Chuck, to use to determine, to estimate what the carbon footprint is of various transportation fuels. And we secured some wins with respect to that, in that the Inflation Reduction Act, Congress stipulated to the Treasury Department when they carry out this new 45Z Clean Fuel Production Tax Credit, which kicks in 2025, so we've got about a year between now and then, they stipulated that Treasury must use the latest GREET model to make emission rate determinations, which is great because some of the other competing models out there, Chuck, maybe don't properly take into account some of the conservation tillage and other sustainable practices farmers employ. So those models would have a larger carbon footprint or carbon intensity score for corn ethanol than is warranted. The GREET model is updated on an annual basis. It does take into consideration what takes place on the farm. And that is a critically important piece because what happens on the farm is about half of ethanol's carbon intensity. It's not just what happens in that ethanol facility. It's also what happens on the farm. So the GREET model is something that we're pushing hard, and it's not just with the IRA. It's also to make sure EPA going forward with the RFS uses that to determine life cycle emissions as well.
So this is a very important thing. I mean, how important is it?
The GREET model can make or break whether demand for ethanol increases in the future through some of these new policies that are coming down the pike. So it is make or break. If the GREET model is not used, here's an example for the 40B Sustainable Aviation Fuel Tax Credit. Ethanol to jet fuel will not be a reality. So the idea that we have an opportunity to tap into a gigantic sustainable aviation fuel market goes away if the GREET model is not allowed to be used to help determine the carbon score under that. And so this is, yes, in some ways it's esoteric, but it also is going to determine whether this is an industry, the ethanol industry, that grows in the future or that shrinks in the future. So it's critically important.
So what is it that holds this up for being used like it should?
Well, nothing's holding it up on the 45Z clean fuel production tax credit. What's holding this up on the 40B sustainable aviation fuel tax credit is that Congress, in their wisdom, also said to Treasury, there's another international aviation model out there that's been used for aviation fuel, and you could use that as well. And that's one of the outdated models that doesn't take into consideration all of these things that are taking place on the farm that reduce the corn ethanol carbon intensity. And so the CI score for ethanol to jet using that international model, Chuck, is so high that we wouldn't qualify for that tax credit. So that's where it gets a little bit tricky. And then the bigger picture is just with EPA using outdated data to estimate our carbon intensity, it's important that they're using something that's more up to date.
What's your outlook as we are now coming to the end of the year and we're going to be in an election year, because we do have some important issues like the extension with the farm bill that apparently got put onto the president's desk yesterday.
And it's my understanding that'll be signed, and I think the farm bill leadership wants to, sooner rather than later in 2024, kind of get that rolling and get that in place. As I look to the election year, you know, E15 really does rise to the top once again because we don't have a nationwide solution in place. We need the Biden administration to quit delaying on the Midwest petition. EPA proposed to approve that for those 8 states. They just damn well need to get that final rule out. And then beyond that, you know, some people observe that it's tough to pass legislation in an election year, but the history would show you that there are some really important opportunities to pass bipartisan legislation in election years. And so we're going to try to get that E15 bill to hitch a ride on a must-pass bill. We're trying to get it done yet this year, Chuck, but the, you know, legislative days are finite and the number of vehicles that are going to the president's desk are also limited, but that's going to be a critical piece. And holding presidential candidates accountable, not simply the incumbent Joe Biden on what he has or has not done relative to E15, but, you know, whoever ends up being the Republican challenger as well.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, for taking time to visit with me here. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back. In the December episode of the Doratree Water for Food podcast, experts talked about a unique growing area, space. We have some of that conversation for you now.
Welcome to the Doherty Water for Food podcast. Since 2010, the Doherty Water for Food Global Institute at the University of Nebraska has worked toward one goal, a food and water secure world, one in which global food security is ensured without compromising the use of water to meet other essential human and environmental needs. It's a daunting vision, but one that is vitally important. This podcast amplifies the voices of those making waves in this space. We hope you enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Frances Hayes, DWFI Director of Communications and Public Relations, and your host for this episode of the Water for Food podcast. I'm joined today by Yufeng Gi, Santosh Pitla, and David Jones, all biological systems engineering faculty at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Among other things, the team has already conducted research in the areas of ag-relevant sensors for more efficient application of fertilizer and water, and the development of an autonomous planter capable of seeding a 5-acre field all on its own. But now, they've set their sights quite a bit higher, growing food in space. Yufeng, Santosh, David, and their research team were awarded a two-year Grand Challenge grant from Nebraska's Office of Research and Economic Development to find ways to sustainably grow food in space. In the short term, they plan to develop a center dedicated to the study of space agriculture here at the University of Nebraska, the first of its kind at a U.S. university. I'm really excited that you all are here, so let's dive in. To start off, I'd just like you to tell us a bit about yourselves and your work up until this point, how you got here.
Yeah, so my name is Santosh Pitla. So my research is in agricultural robotics and automation. So I think robotics and automation have potential to be really good climate smart agriculture tools. So that's kind of my research has been the last 6-7 years. So now we are looking at how can we grow food in space. So I also think autonomy and robotics will play a huge role in how we grow food in space.
Yeah, so my work has primarily focusing on sensing and instrumentation part of the agricultural engineering. So I develop sensors and looking at sensors from other sectors and then trying to find a new use, their new use in agricultural settings. So particularly looking at things like imaging sensors or spectroscopic sensors. And hopefully we can improve our efficiency using those sensors for agricultural research and also production agricultural. So I'm also a proud member of the DWFI faculty member.
David Jones, and my work has largely been in systems modeling and describing those complex systems mathematically and graphically. And as we look at how we are conducting agriculture, and then we project where we are now to what it would look like in space, that's a very exciting way to describe those systems from almost a limitless area, if the planet Earth is limitless, to a very confined space while we're in space. And being able to bridge between what we do on Earth versus what we would project to do in space. And hopefully we will learn in both directions.
Thank you. So growing food in space seems like such a long shot from an outside perspective, something that would be really hard to do. So walk me through how you landed on this Grand Challenges idea and why you decided to actually tangibly pursue something like that.
Well, I'll start with the last part first. Why? And it in part goes back to where we need to learn from what we our investigations in space to how they would benefit us now in the short term. And we need to challenge some of the solutions that we're wanting to deploy now and use the space application to test them to see if they hold up to the rigors of that. And so it becomes, in some ways, a stress test for the solutions we're offering now. And that is one of many motivators for pursuing that.
Well, one other motivator really is, you know, we talk a lot about climate change, right? So the increase of the temperature or the higher frequency of those extreme extreme environments, you know, such as rainfall, drought, you know, almost natural disaster type of events. So, you know, when we talk about the climate change and extreme environment, you know, what else can be more extreme than the space environment? So we really think that this is a very good test ground and a use case, if you will, that we can really looking at what are that extreme facing the agriculture potentially in the future. You know, we are not talking about 3 or 5 years or 50 years down the road. We're probably talking about hundreds of years or thousands of years down the road. And, you know, being able to speculate what it is and, you know, being able to conduct research on those environment would be really exciting.
Yeah, I think in addition, if you think about last 10 years, we have made many advances in rocket launches. There are more and more missions to Moon and Mars. And in the next 20 to 30 years, having a manned mission. So then what? It's the biggest thing, you know. People will be there on Moon and Mars. Then how does the ag and food system look like? So that's kind of one of the motivators. And also this extreme environment, like you mentioned, you know, how do we grow food in extreme environments, including extreme environments on Earth? How can we make some of the extreme environments on Earth productive? Is there an opportunity there? So those are all the motivators.
So I think you touched on my next question in this question, but if you could expand on that a little bit, what would you say to someone who might wonder why we should care about growing crops on other planets when we already have so many challenges here? Shouldn't we try to fix those first? Mm-hmm. What would you say to them?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons that why we should do that, even though that we have a lot of problems existing right now here on Earth. But I will touch one, and then Santosh and David can, you know, join. And so, you know, one of that would be really thinking about how we can conduct agriculture more efficiently, right? So, you know, we know here we need water, we need nitrogen, we need phosphorus. So those are the biggest three that we manage, you know, essentially on a constant basis, figuring out ways how to manage and use them efficiently here on Earth. Now, if you look at the space environment, you know, there is no water, there is no nitrogen, no phosphorus in easy way that we can use it, right? So therefore, you know, I think one of the bigger challenges we're facing when we talk about a space ag is going to be, well, how can we utilizing those resources more efficiently? I think as soon as we learn how to do that, and that would essentially we can bring back the technology and discovery there to here to solve the problems that we are facing right now.
Yeah, I think what Dr. Yufeng said, you know, is absolutely right. But also it's about a change in our thought process, you know. So here on Earth, we still have a lot of abundance in terms of, you know, nitrogen and water. But then in the coming years, it might not be the case, right? So to have a better appreciation of how things can look like an extreme environment, I think we can look at space, you know, where things are very extreme and very resource deficient. So, you know, can we manage to grow food there and with minimal resources? And that will have a lot of implications, you know, to do things better on Earth as well. So,
So what I'm hearing is that the things that you learn about space can be easily transferred to Earth, right? Since that's an even more extreme environment. So that's interesting.
There are past histories, right? So about how exploring space and trying to grow food in space, so develop the technologies that actually have a huge impacts on the Earth agriculture. So I'll give you one example. That's LED. So LED lighting, widely used for urban farming and indoor farming. And that is technology being developed by the NASA back in the time when they do the space agriculture research.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
We will continue with the Doherty Water for Food podcast right after this. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour, and now we continue with this special presentation of the Doherty Water for Food podcast.
We need to rethink how do we irrigate crops in space. So that's a big challenge.
So you mentioned gravity and soil and water. I want to hear what each of you thinks is the biggest challenge in growing food in space that you think will be the hardest to overcome.
I can go first. You know, I think, you know, I am sort of kind of usually like to approach this in a research mind. So therefore, I search literature and read the literature, right? So what the literature tell us is, so the most frequently studied interaction of plants and the space environment would be radiation, right? So we know that radiation changes DNA. It damages DNA. So, and then there is a problem about the type of radiation. You know, some of them, the ionization, some of them, you know, like ultraviolet, we know that's going to cause damages. And the amount and the quality of the radiation is important, right? As you go, you know, as you go through, go to the Mars and go to the moons, and you're going to, you know, experience different type and quantity of radiation. And one other thing is we don't know, we never, you know, we don't have enough experiments done to ask whether the DNA damage is heritable or not, right? Because we usually don't do generational studies. You see those damages on the individual, but you don't know if they reproduce, are you going to have an accumulative effect, right? Because that's important. You know, if we truly want to have a settlement on the Mars, then we have to be there for maybe a couple of generations, maybe a lot of generations. So what's that going to impact our plants and a crop and a food system eventually? So that's something always gets in my mind.
There's a long list, but you know, to Yufeng's previous statement about the lack of organic matter is going to be a major challenge. And the cropping system's first purpose may be to produce organic matter, right? And so thinking about how we stage the deployment and ramp up to where we can grow that first acre of corn, for example, that's part of the strategy that we hope to think through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think for me, robots need to get to the Mars or Moon and start producing food before humans can actually go there, you know? And how do you scale these food production systems? And how do these autonomous systems look like? You know, they need to be, you know, really, really robust. They cannot fail. So how many human interventions are needed? You know, the last thing astronauts need to worry about is growing food. But how can we develop this perfect high-tech farm hands, if you want to call it that way, you know? So it's kind of what I keep thinking about.
Yeah, the robot farmer.
The robot farmer. Yeah.
What are some of the agricultural technologies or principles that exist now that you see as a natural fit to bring to space? What are the low-hanging fruits that you think will work well under those extreme conditions?
So for me, I think greenhouses here is, you know, it's easy to translate to a greenhouse in space. I think the big thing is the energy requirements. How does that look like, you know? So to begin with, I would say you have to grow food in a controlled environment. So controlled environment principles that you see here will be applicable there with some changes in gravity, you know, and so on and so forth. I think we're not going to directly go and try to grow food in outdoor conditions there. So the NECEA principles, I would say controlled environment ag principles will be applied.
Thank you again to the Doherty Water for Food podcast.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.